Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Music, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Kimberly Mack, and I'm a host on the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Ann Powers about her book, Good Booty, Love and Sex, Black and White, Body and Soul in American Music. Ann Powers is one of the nation's leading popular music writers. Since 2011, she has been NPR's music's critic and correspondent. She has held various writing and editing positions at publications such as the San Francisco Weekly, the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and the Village Voice. She was also the senior curator at the Experience Music Project, now the Museum of Popular Culture in Seattle. Her books include Weird Like Us, My Bohemian America, Tori Amos, Piece by Piece, which she co-wrote with Amos, and Rock She Wrote, Women Write About Rock, Rap, and Pop, which she co-edited with Evelyn McDonald. She was also the editor of Best Music Writing 2010. Powers earned a BA in Creative Writing from San Francisco State University and an MA in American Literature from UC Berkeley. She lives in Nashville. Ann Powers, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we'll just start at the beginning. Can you tell me a little bit about Good Booty and how you came to write it?
Yeah, I've been doing this music writing thing for many decades and over many decades. When you are a writer for your whole life, you notice themes that keep coming up or obsessions, passions. And my passion and obsession has always been understanding how sexuality and gender works within popular music, how popular music actually forms a language through which we, I'm going to, my book talks about Americans, but really, people around the world understand sexuality, experience their bodies, and talk to each other about desire, you know, and about all of the omniverse surrounding desire. I guess I'm kind of, you know, I'm known as a feminist critic or someone who writes about gender a lot, and that definitely interests me. But I always intended this book to be about the erotic. Not so much about identity, but about expression, experience, sensuality, all of the that realm versus one that was strictly about identity. Although definitely, as we can talk about, identity factors in because as humans in society, of course, we experience desire and longing and yearning through the lens of our identities. So anyway. So for many years, I was writing about this material in different ways in all of my work, whether it was in previous books, my book with Tori, she definitely is interested in these same themes, or in, you know, my journalism and criticism. So when it came time for me to sort of do this passion project of mine, you know, the book that you were born to write, I actually was having lunch with Josh Kuhn, a friend who people might know from his work in Los Angeles. He's a professor at USC, and he does a lot of amazing work on border music and border culture and also on Jewish American music. Anyway, super smart, great guy. And we were talking, and I'm like, you know, I just don't know what should I, what, how do I frame my big book, as they say. And he's like, Anne, you got to write that book on sexuality and music, because that's what you've been doing all this time, and you've got to own it in a book. So I thank Josh for pushing me over the edge to finally write the proposal that I then wrote. But in the process of writing the book, I discovered that it was to approach this topic, this very, very multifaceted topic, was also to approach other fundamental elements of human experience, most notably, especially talking about American culture, race, and the interaction of people in culture across different boundaries of identity, I guess. And so that became another focus of the book.
Okay. How long, so you mentioned it was a passion project. How long did it take you to write the book?
In many ways, my entire life. I kind of write about that in the preface. You know, I talk about when I was a kid, I first, you know, when I fell in love with pop music, it was always about experiencing desire in some ways. And you know, I fell in love with popular music and Paul McCartney at the same moment. He was my first crush, and loving the Beatles music and loving his music. I was not a original Beatle maniac. I was actually born in 64, the year the Beatles came to America. But it's funny. I think there was a reissue or a release of a Beatles record in, I think it was 1977 or so. So I would have been 13, and it was Beatles Live at the Hollywood Bowl. And it's interesting recording because it's really full of girls screaming, you know. And around that same time that record came out, I had discovered the White Album and Magical Mystery Tour, which a friend of mine, her mom had those records. And I had, as importantly, discovered the photographs of Paul that were included with those albums. And I had just developed this kind of crazy crush on Paul McCartney, who, you know, existed in 1967 or whatever, 68, 69. So I was already kind of spanning the decades with the magic of recording technology. But from that moment, I was always very engaged with music as a conduit for exploring desire, I guess. And, you know, so I think that's always been sort of a place where I stand when I think about music. The book itself took about 6 years from proposal to publication.
So this leads us very nicely into the next question. Your title, what is Good Booty?
Well, Good Booty is whatever you make of it, I suppose. But historically, the title sources from a song that Little Richard recorded in 1955. At Cosimo Matassa's studio in New Orleans. And Little Richard had been playing on this club circuit in throughout the South, roadhouses and bars where lots of different kinds of performers frequented, including drag performers and you know, queer performers, although of course they weren't known under that identity marker at that time. Mm-hmm. But this song, he either discovered or sort of elaborated upon and created from other sources. And the original lyrics to Tutti Frutti were quite raunchy. And with phrases like, if you grease it, make it easy, referring to various erotic encounters. And Good Booty was part of that lyric. When he got into the studio with his producer Bumps Blackwell and you know, sat down to record the song, Bumps thought, you know, this is never going to get on the radio. It's just too dirty. So a young woman named Dorothy Labastri was kind of hanging out trying to get a break as a songwriter, and they enlisted Dorothy to rewrite the song with Little Richard, and that's how we got the kind of nonsense lyrics that we know, you know, Tutti Frutti, all Rudy, that kind of thing. But in fact, the original lyric was Tutti Frutti, Good Booty.
That's great. So you talk about sex in the book, and then you also talk about the erotic, as you said.
Yes.
What is the distinction you're making between the two? How are you defining the erotic?
Well, absolutely referring to Audre Lorde's idea of the erotic, which she talks about in her essay entitled The Uses of the Erotic, where she talks about the erotic as this the core energy or spirit, I guess, if you were into that kind of language, inside a person that is about enjoying yourself in a way. but it's deeper than that. When we say that, I think it sounds almost like, you know, a flippant idea of self-care or, you know, mm-hmm. I don't know, like going and watching Magic Mike, if you're into that kind of thing, you know, or whatever you're into. But really what Audre Lorde is getting at in her essay is this essence within people that's about relishing your life, you know, and relishing yourself and your ability to connect with others. And that sounds like a big blousy idea, but Audre Lorde talks about it as the element that makes resilience possible in people. And what I found as I was pursuing this topic, and I didn't necessarily expect this when I started writing this book, was that that story of that spark is really the story of popular music in America, because it is the story of African-American people in America, you know, and all American popular music is rooted in African-American music. So from the time, you know, from the very colonial beginnings of our country to the present. And so tracing that thread of how music, you know, is a language and a way of preserving cultures that the dominant, you know, the state and other forces would have eradicated, and also a way of celebrating one's humanity, one's community, one's intimate connections with others. I found myself also tracing, I guess, a political story, the fundamental story about race in our nation. Also, I will say one more thing, which is that I think eroticism, that's sense of the erotic, defining the erotic in this way, another way to think about it is the erotic becomes the setting. That's not exactly right, but it becomes I usually say the language, but of encounter with, quote unquote, the other, you know? And so another fundamental American story is the story of very different kinds of people meeting and connecting and forming a new nation, forming new society, certainly under hierarchies of oppression, which I always want to acknowledge and talk about a lot in the book, but also like in intimate ways, and music becomes the way of telling those stories as well, if that makes any sense.
It does. Does joy factor in there anywhere?
Absolutely. And I think Audre Lorde would be happy that you asked that question. Absolutely. Joy. Dancing, you know, that's why dancing is so important in this story, and why in the, you know, in my first very long chapter on New Orleans and kind of starting with pre-Louisiana Purchase New Orleans and going forward all the way to the dawn of the 20th century and the birth of jazz, that chapter is as much about dancing in some ways, and the way that dancing was both an activity and a code for people crossing lines they weren't supposed to cross, and also for people preserving cultures that weren't supposed to be preserved. And of course, it's also a way of touching other people, literally. and involved in that is a lot of joy.
Yeah, great. So in your book, first of all, Good Booty is it's an impressively researched book. Where you engage source material from African-American and American history, American popular music, Black feminist and womanist theories and more. What were some of your challenges in pulling all of this together?
Well, amazing. A major challenge is just my identity, you know, my subject position as a white, heterosexual, cishet woman, right? So I fundamentally believe that it is absolutely necessary for me to think every day, every time I sit down to write or I talk to people or I talk to someone like you for a podcast or do anything that is an act of communicating my ideas about popular music, that I have to really consider my subject position, my privilege. So, you know, there's a long history in music writing of romanticizing the erotic and also of perpetuating stereotypes of people of color as primitive, as, you know, quote unquote, more sexual, as quote unquote, you know, more free, but also sort of more dangerous. And a lot of those myths have been propagated through music writing, honestly, so much. And so I had to be careful about my own susceptibility to those myths, and also in using source material to always like acknowledge it when white writers are writing about people of color and their culture, to always point that out, while also trying, you know, that's the material we, you know, in a lot of cases, that's the material we have. We have no firsthand accounts, for example, of enslaved people in Congo Square. I talk about Congo Square in New Orleans, where enslaved people were brought together on Sundays and allowed a market, and often danced, and where white observers even entered the ring where they were dancing. That to me is a very sort of like a ground zero for a lot of American popular culture. And but how can I talk about that? You know, and the only accounts we have are from white observers. So I just had to be really delicate with that. So that was definitely a major challenge that I hope I lived up to. Another challenge is, you know, this book is written for a general audience. And as you know, Kim, because we're friends and we've become friends through the POP conference, which is a great gathering of all kinds of scholars that always happens in April of every year, where people from within and beyond the academy get together to talk about ideas. I'm very much a part of this kind of community where scholars who are writing in an academic style and journalists and critics come together. I was writing for, you know, HarperCollins and for Day Street Books, and this is a general interest press. And so, you know, I had to figure out what's the language, that I can use to engage with theory, as you were saying, engage with the discourse that's happening within the academy, while also making this vivid and readable for someone who might not have ever picked up, you know, a book by, I don't know, Farah Jasmine Griffin, you know, or Imani Perry, or so many of the scholars that I respect. And I should say both of those writers write for a general audience too. So, you know, I feel like I'm part of a community of writers who are really trying to bridge that gap. And it's a community that's flourished in the past few decades in the U.S., but it is still a challenge. I mean, I know, you know, some people might say this book is too academic. Others might say it's not academic enough, but that's where I live. I live in that space.
That makes a lot of sense to me. So did you have any unexpected joys that came out of reaching to the archive?
Oh my gosh, so many. I had so many unexpected joys. Finding stuff, you know, one unexpected joy was going to the archive at Fisk University and going through the papers of Thomas A. Dorsey, the founding father of contemporary or 20th century gospel music, really. And, you know, touching his own papers, you know, where he wrote songs, like the very paper upon which he wrote songs. Of course, I was wearing gloves, so don't worry. But, but you know, finding stuff in those archives, also going through Florence Mills, the Florence Mills archive. I became a little bit obsessed with Florence Mills, who was a theatrical performer in the U.S. in the teens and 20s. And she died very young, and she never recorded anything either on film or in a, you know, an audio recording. And so she's somewhat forgotten, but she was one of the greatest stars of the New York stage. And she was a very modern performer. And I argue that she not only embodied this kind of new woman among African-American entertainers, which she absolutely did, but that in general, she should be acknowledged as the embodiment of the new woman as much as any flapper who is, you know, whom F. Scott Fitzgerald immortalized. And it was really great to go to the Schomburg and be able to look through her papers as well. So there were lots of thrill moments like that. I also got to go to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and do research there. I found a whole stash of fan letters that Eddie Cochran's mother had saved. And that was really fun to go through those. And Eddie Cochran died very young in an automobile accident, but he was another, along with Elvis and Little Richard and Chuck Berry, was a major rock and roll star. And looking at these fan letters, I learned things about how fans related to those early rockers that I really hadn't thought about before, like how intimate and ongoing those relationships sometimes were and how important those teenage girls were to supporting the careers of these guys. And it was just fun to read those letters too, because, you know, there's nothing like a teenage girl and the way she talks to a boy she likes.
So you mentioned Florence Mills. You also talked about gospel pioneer Dorothy Love Coates. Are there any other underappreciated artists like these that maybe you didn't get to include in the book?
Oh, interesting. Interesting question. Well, I don't think these people are underappreciated. So I'm going to talk about them. I am currently working on a new project that's centered on Joni Mitchell, and looking at singer-songwriters of the late 60s, early 70s in Los Angeles and beyond. And I've been thinking a lot about Joni and Laurel Canyon artists, and also people like Bob Dylan. And all of those people got very short shrift in my book. For the 60s chapter, I chose to focus on certain scenes and on just a few particular stars. I have a section on Jim Morrison or Janis Joplin. I have a section on Jimi Hendrix. But I, just by nature of, you know, the limitations of writing a book, I couldn't get into everybody's story. So it's been really interesting to think about the singer-songwriter tradition and how, while we might not think of that as such a an overt expression of eroticism and sexuality, in fact, it was really a key locus of storytelling about the changing attitudes about sexuality. And certainly exploring Joni's work has been fruitful on that count. So, I'm okay that she's not in this book, because she'll get her own book. But I just want to say now, I gave her a little short shrift in this one.
Yeah. Okay. So you begin your book, as you mentioned earlier, in the antebellum South, with a story within your story about a memoir by Thomas C. Nichols about his experience at 17 visiting New Orleans and witnessing a procession of wealthy young white women dressed in grand finery, walking barefoot to a local ballroom to dance through the mud and attended by their black slaves. Throughout your book, you share many colorful individual stories, sort of unexpected stories. Why did you decide to use this approach when writing Good Booty?
I suppose that's my journalistic side, pushing me toward, you know, specifics and people and voices. And when you're doing archival work, as anyone knows who's listening to this podcast who does that kind of work, those voices are embedded in letters and memoirs and autobiographical accounts like the one you just cited. So I was always looking for those anecdotes that would exemplify an idea or a trend. Also, I think, I don't know, for me, I kind of fell in love with these characters, you know. And as I said before, talking about Florence Mills, I would really have a little relationship with them, you know. Who was Thomas Nichols, you know, thinking about him in that position? What was his point of view? You know, were his eyes wide as he saw these ladies taking off their stockings? Was he nervous, you know? Did he even notice that the slaves who were attending to them were not allowed to dance, you know? Was that a factor? Those kinds of questions animate the history that I'm relating and sharing, and make it, you know, feel relevant today, and also just allow us to imagine ourselves in that situation. So we always imagine ourselves through fantastical encounters with other people. I think it's like dreams, right? So I dreamed of Thomas Nichols. I dreamed of Florence Mills. I dreamed of Thomas Dorsey writing "Take My Hand, Precious Lord" after his wife had died, and the tragedy of his losing his young wife and his son in childbirth. All of those imaginary encounters allowed me to feel emotionally invested in this material and hopefully communicate that same sense of emotion to the reader.
In your third chapter, you focused on gospel music, and you compare gospel quartets like the Songbirds of the South and the Spirit of Memphis to rock bands. Can you talk a little more about that?
Yeah, that's a crazy idea that I put forward. That I totally, you know, sometimes you have, you're writing stuff and you're like, oh yeah, everybody thinks of, for example, like Jim Morrison, everybody thinks of him as a debauched rock god. And if I talk about him in that way, it's not really new. Maybe I can just talk about it in a lively way that reinforces what we already know. But sometimes you have an idea and you're like, huh, maybe I'm completely wrong, but I'm just going to throw this out there. So that's sort of what happened with this. I was not an expert on gospel when I started writing that chapter. I really had to immerse. One reason this book took me so long was because I would spend, you know, 6 months to a year before I could even start writing a chapter, because I had to like educate myself. And with gospel music, that's what happened. I started exploring different facets of it. I live in the South, so I think I was particularly engaged with the histories of these performers who were moving throughout the South. And I started to notice certain things about these quartets, certain elements of their music and of the way their live performances were talked about. You can see a lot of clips of gospel quartets on YouTube and stuff like that. And I started thinking, wow, okay, so they're not playing guitar, bass, and drums necessarily. Usually they're a cappella, but, and yet there's the way in which these men would relate to each other, certain movements, you know, choreographed or not, certain ways they vocalized really made me think about, rock bands, you know, whether it was the kind of homosocial, verging on homoerotic, energy flowing among them, or the way they related to their audience. I mean, they really turned the women on, you know, even though it was all for Jesus. or, you know, something like the drive, which is a section of a gospel song, with sort of like an improv section that happens half, two thirds of the way in, and how that replicated kind of the build in a rock song. So I just threw that theory out there. I hope people like it.
Great. So I'm going to read a little short excerpt from chapter four and ask you a question about it. So in chapter four, you say, "What rock and roll added to the equation was a commitment to representing adolescence, not adulthood, and a unique combination of fantasy and accessibility. To teens, the stars of rock and roll were just like them and could very possibly become their friends or even lovers. For teenage girls, a sense of intimate possibility within rock and roll blended with a growing social acknowledgement of their own sexuality to form a potent elixir." This section, that the chapter in general, is particularly striking, you know, particularly in the Me Too era, as you talk frankly about the ways in which rock and roll provided an outlet for teenage girls' sexual fantasies and existed within this paradigm where adult male rock stars like Elvis, Chuck Berry, and Jerry Lee Lewis engaged in sexual acts with underage girls.
Yes.
Can you talk a little more about this chapter and just how you kind of grappled with all of that?
Yeah. I mean, so I wrote this book before. You hear the hesitancy. how do I answer this question? First of all, I guess I'll say, as someone who once was a teenage girl and who currently is the mom of a teenage girl, I'm very interested and always have been in telling the stories of teenage girls. And I think I'm part of a contingency of, oh, sorry, that's the wrong word. I think I'm part of like a little group of critics, writers, scholars who are really champions of teenage girls. You know, you might start with that essay that Barbara Ehrenreich and some other people wrote about how the girls who screamed for the Beatles, that was sort of like one root of American feminism. Susan Douglas, and the historian, she's written about the importance of teenage girls in the formation of feminist consciousness in the U.S. So these were writers who were influences on me, and I've written many, many, many pieces about teen culture. When I turned to the 50s and wanted to think about that subject for this book, as I said before, I had been able to go into the archive of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and I discovered these fan letters, and I realized that those encounters between teenage girls in the 50s and their idols were not simply imaginary. You know, I mean, the rock and roll circuit was a lot more, it was a lot smaller than what we think it might have been, because I think now we see rock and roll through the lens of arena rock, which had, I write about this too. I mean, there was certainly a lot of encounters among rock stars and teenage girls in the 70s, many of them quite disturbing. But in the 50s, it was a small scene, right? And so Elvis was always a huge star, but even Elvis, when he would go to these small towns or Midwestern cities or Southern cities, and these girls and would be right there. Like, the connection was real. It was physical. And, you know, I found this one amazing letter called the Kiss Letter. That's a housed at UNC in their folklore archive. And it's a letter from a teenage girl describing kissing Elvis and how he was backstage kissing what seems like dozens of teen girls after he performed one time. You know, I think that she was delighted by this. You read the letter and it's like she was thrilled to have had this experience. And we're not talking a peck. I mean, the way she describes the kiss, it's like long, deep, French, all of those things. I mean, he was definitely, what, you know, in another description, we would call this sexual assault potentially. Mm-hmm. But you know, she describes it as a high point of her young life. So I was really intrigued by this, the fact that what I think historians and others have always considered to be sort of a fantasy realm was actually a real realm, you know, or at least seemed like a potential real experience for so many girls in the 50s. And then things get sort of change in the 60s and 70s because rock and popular music in general becomes such a much bigger more corporatized arena. So I was really interested in that. But I was writing this before the Me Too movement. And, you know, I really tried to be, I always am conscientious of, you know, how do you balance celebrating the empowerment and acknowledging the empowerment of these girls and their sense of their own sexuality and their desire and determination to express themselves sexually and their mm-hmm. right to do so. How do we balance that with the fact that some of them are also being exploited and, you know, that these adult men are choosing to have encounters with these sometimes very young girls. And, you know, I've written about this subsequently. It's like so many of the biggest stars of early rock and roll had very serious and long-term relationships with very young women, young girls. You know, Elvis, his wife, Priscilla, she was, 13, 14 when they met. Obviously, Jerry Lee Lewis, Chuck Berry. Buddy Holly was an interesting exception. But, you know, most of these guys had much younger girlfriends or wives. So it's kind of embedded in the history of rock and roll. And it's also in the songs. You know, so many classic rock and roll songs are about teenage queens, about really, really young girls and their power over men, their power to shape culture. But, you know, you can look at these another way and it's like kind of creepy and predatory, right? So I guess it's about that balancing act of like acknowledging that individual girls and young women did feel empowered by these experiences. That's, you know, by their own accounts. And I really think it's wrong to not acknowledge that, you know, that's taking away their agency in a different way. But at the same time, it's the foundation of an architecture of hierarchies and exploitations within popular music that now, you know, that eventually leads to R. Kelly, you know, and leads to those kinds of really horrifying realities.
Yeah. So then how does it shift? You know, in the next chapter, you talk about Jimi Hendrix and Jim Morrison and Janis Joplin as countercultural sex symbols.
Yeah.
And then in the next chapter, you talk about groupies.
Yeah.
How does this shift? How does the, you know, the young teenagers who are following this music, and charting the erotic, how does that shift as time passes?
Well, I really think it's a capitalist story, you know. It's a story about money as much as it's about sex and sexism. And it's about the growth of the music industry and specifically the live music industry. Let's just take within rock. I think you can probably trace these same patterns within R&B and funk and soul. I found some interesting, I did a lot of archival research at Lincoln Center Library and New York Public Library into old rock magazines and from the 70s and Rolling Stone, Cream, Circus, magazines like this. There was even one called Star, which you can find online that was actually devoted. It was sort of like a teen beat magazine, but for girls who wanted to basically sleep with rock stars. Mm-hmm. And it's a pretty disturbing document. So looking at those magazines, what you see is the growth of this industry. Bands start to play, you know, sort of starting in the mid 60s when you have the festival circuit. Then that, you know, you have these huge festivals, Woodstock, Monterey Pop, Watts Stax eventually. Then you have kind of connected to and springing out of that, these very big tours. Bands start to play arenas. They start to play, they're not playing in small clubs, you know. They're on the road constantly, and touring is a huge part of this lifestyle, this machine. And the machine sells records. And the machine also sells tickets and generates a lot of money. And in order for the machine to operate, the musicians have to stay on the road. And they have to commit to weeks, months of touring and playing in places where their music doesn't sound very good, and they're sleeping in a different hotel every night, and they're on a bus, and part of what keeps them going is the quote unquote reward of meeting women, right, in mm-hmm. every town, if they're heterosexual. I think there's a whole very, very buried queer story in here that I only get to explore, I only touch upon it, but both in terms of, you know, well, I guess I haven't seen the new Elton John movie. maybe that happens in that movie, but in Rocket Man, but, you know, yeah. both consensual encounters and then also, honestly, exploitation. And there's been some really horrifying cases, especially in Europe, in England, of people like Gary Glitter who were really abusing children, and male and female. So anyway, I digress. So this system, this thing I call the groupie system, exists, which means that, you know, the artists, they are being exploited in a way. They're also benefiting hugely, obviously financially, and they're enjoying the fruits of fame, but they're forced to be on the road all the time. And then part of the package, what's sort of provided for them, is these women and these sometimes often teenage girls. And everything within the system creates the possibility for those encounters. You know, I think in the Me Too era, we think we often try to cancel or critique or you know, express our moral indignation toward musicians. And I'm not saying that they don't deserve it often, but we need to also talk about the promoters, the managers, the people who worked at the hotels, the people who worked at the venues, mm-hmm. Who were like creating these pathways for these girls to meet these guys. Right. So like I found this one, account of the Hyatt House in Los Angeles on Sunset Strip, which I think was published in Time. I can't remember off the top of my head, Time or Newsweek magazine. And it was about, you know, the Hyatt House, the ultimate rock and roll hotel. And that was like where Led Zeppelin hung out, the most notorious band in terms of encounters with groupies probably in the history of 70s rock. And many bands, everyone hung out at the Hyatt House. And in this article, it describes how the staff of the hotel had basically been instructed to let these underage girls run rampant in the hotel. And run rampant makes it sound like they had tons of agency. It's pretty disturbing. Like there's one paragraph about how a girl is passed out in the elevator and people just leave her, you know? The elevator's going up and down and this mm-hmm. poor kid is passed out. But, you know, why wasn't anybody doing anything there? You know, it's because right. all of this adds up to a way to reward the musicians who are getting exhausted on the road. And I think that pattern it continues to exist today. You know, I think Me Too has done a lot and continues to do a lot for raising consciousness about these situations. And I you know, I'm hoping and I'm seeing some evidence that things are changing, but certainly at the height of corporate rock, this was reality. And plus, don't forget drugs and alcohol, huge part of this story. One that's not talked about enough, I think. You know, so often these guys in these bands were so high and so wasted that their moral judgment was truly impeded. And the girls were too, you know?
You mentioned that you did touch a bit on queerness in addition to race and gender in your book. You talk a yeah. little bit about sexuality.
Yes.
And you know, you talk about Madonna and Prince.
Yeah.
Bowie. And then you also mentioned something that I thought was, you included the Cream magazine writer, Vincelletti,
yes,
who was not particularly happy with the glam rock scene, or thought that was very interesting how, you know, it seemed as though Bowie and folks who were participating in glam rock perhaps were creating a space for fluid sexual experimentation or sexual identity, but then you had someone like Vince Aletti who was saying not so fast.
Right. Right. Vince is a great writer. Someone I knew when I worked at the Village Voice, he was actually the art critic for the Village Voice and photography critic when I worked there in the 90s. But in the 70s, he's a really important music writer. And he wrote for Cream and Rolling Stone and actually was the very first American writer to write about disco music. There's a great book called The Disco Files that collects all of his writing on disco. I really recommend it to anyone who's interested in disco. But Vince, when he was writing about rock, you know, as a gay man, he made a very fundamental observation, which is, you know, it's great that we have these gender fluid performances, but there still are no songs in which a man expresses desire for another man. You know, there are no songs actually talking about gay love. And there really weren't very many. I mean, there was an artist I talk about, Joe Bryath, who was had a brief, shining, meteoric career. He was a theater kid, like a member of the cast of Hair, and a promoter discovered him, and he made a couple records that are explicit, and he toured. He had a brief and disastrous arena rock tour, but you know, it didn't catch fire. And I think that, you know, exposes the homophobia within rock and roll, even at its most gender fluid at that time. And you know, someone like Bowie, it's complicated because, oh, I just have to interrupt and say, if you hear that barking, that's my little poodle. But anyway, you know, I'm a huge Bowie fan, and I think, and I actually recently wrote an essay for an anthology that Daphne Brooks is editing out of Yale from a conference she organized about David Bowie and Prince, where I write about Bowie and Prince as these sort of, and this idea of the heterosexual closet, which is, you know, these men who were, I think, I mean, I didn't know them personally. I was lucky to meet Prince once, never got to meet David Bowie. But, you know, from accounts that we have, it seems like they were on the spectrum closer to straight. You know, they, the most significant love relationships were with women, et cetera. But you know, they occupied fluidity and kind of allowed a gateway. Is that a strange, maybe that's a strange way to talk about it, but they allowed their listeners to think about, you know, a wide array of erotic connections, even though they were kind of fundamentally still expressing a heterosexual viewpoint. And I think there's wonderful things about that. But I also agree with Vince that, you know, the fact that we, and it's 2019, and there are still so few songs that really talk about same-sex love openly. You know, this is one of the final frontiers, and that's crazy. And I think fans of rock and roll often give themselves too much credit, frankly, for their openness, when in fact there was historically a lot of homophobia. And I think once you get into the 80s and you see what happened during the HIV/AIDS crisis, which I also write about, the plague, you know, that becomes very clear.
Okay. So your last chapter, you talk about Britney Spears.
Yes.
You also talk about Beyonce. Mm-hmm. So you talk about Britney Spears as a cyborg. Can you just say a little bit more about that?
Yes, I found this piece of fan art, which was kind of amazing, and it showed Britney with half of her face peeled off, and exposing the inner workings of a cyborg, and that really got me thinking about her and about the role she played in pop music at a moment when a new generation was coming of age and was coming of age in a new way, right, through experiences online and also through a rapidly growing cosmetic surgery industry. So even teenagers are, you know, starting in the 2000s, you find all these accounts of like teenage girls considering getting breast implants and teenage boys taking steroids, right? And so the millennial and post-millennial generations who love Britney Spears and for whom she was an avatar, you know, they're thinking about themselves, their sexuality, their identities in a way that is to previous generations, including, I guess, myself, seem almost like science fiction, right? And so Britney, she is a perfect pop star for that moment because of her voice. It's not so much her body or her physical presence because, she, you know, if you look at especially early pictures of Britney, she's like the girl next door. I actually have a little magnet that someone gave me from the very first promotional, like, package that was sent out to journalists when Britney was debuting. And it was a pink backpack and it was full of like some blue lip gloss and some other things. I had these little magnets and it's a picture of Britney. It just says Britney and it's very wholesome looking. Like I actually have it on my fridge and people don't even notice. They think it's just one of my nieces. You know, she doesn't look different than anybody else. But her voice, you know, she was working with the producer Max Martin, who is the biggest star and innovator of Scandinavian pop, which really took over popular music in the early mid 2000s. And her voice is processed, so processed and really, you know, the perfect voice for an age of digital music when voices can be kind of chopped up and sped up and auto-tuned and compressed. And so to me, She was just a great emblem of a time when we are all starting to live and experience desire and experience connection in these ways that that feel very science fiction-y at times.
Well, and Beyoncé, I thought the part about Beyoncé was particularly interesting, this idea of her persona. And being able to be a person who has both a public life and a private life. Mm-hmm. And then you include an interview where Beyoncé says, a little quote from her, "And when I perform, this confidence and this sexiness and this whatever it is that I'm completely not just happens," unquote.
Yes.
I thought that was really striking. So what does Beyoncé's desire and ability, let's say, to hold the boundary between her public and private selves say about this sort of this larger thing that you're exploring in your book about the sex and the erotic in American popular music?
Well, what happens in the 21st century as we all go online and we all begin to experience our lives as, you know, eventually almost as much online as in the meat world, as I think William Gibson once called it, is that people need new role models in order to understand how to manage these new experiences. And one thing I see in Beyoncé's career is that she becomes a kind of role model for this. You know, she's always been a paragon of self-control, and she's always been a highly managed and self-managed pop star. I think, you know, her biography, the story of how she started in this girl group that was managed by her dad, and then there were some conflicts, and she kind of took over, but at the same time, she gets together with her husband, eventual husband, Jay-Z, and they form this empire. You know, he's one of the most successful rappers, and he's a mogul, and she becomes this superstar, and I think a great artist, but also a very you know, someone who just exemplifies drive and ambition and self-control. Well, this works within both within her art within her music, really within her videos, and also within her online presence, to kind of help people understand how to negotiate life online, right? So I talk about the video Single Ladies and how that became, you know, kind of the first video meme where people were imitating the dance she did. And she's dressed in that video. It's her with two other dancers, and she's wearing this glove that looks like a virtual reality glove. So, and she's in an Infinity Cove, which is, you know, a cinematic technique that of set design that makes you look like you're kind of floating in a white space. Also used by Madonna, interestingly enough, in one of her early videos. So she's, you know, she's like in this infinite space. She's not in the world. And she's kind of like an avatar that you would see on a screen. So that's one way that she connects herself to the cyber world. And then when she, you know, starts to use social media, and she's using Instagram and Tumblr and these social media platforms to curate her life. You know, she stopped doing interviews. She stopped basically messing with the conventional media. And she's like, you know what, I'm just going to do it all myself. I'm going to create my own documentary specials. I'm going to, you know, put pictures. When she had her children, she, you know, her first daughter, and she went through a lot and told the story of what she'd gone through to become a mom. You know, she documented this all on her Tumblr, I think, first, and then her Instagram. And by doing that, she's showing others like how you might do this and still maintain an aura of privacy and control over yourself. You know, meanwhile, other celebrities, including Britney, are falling victim to scandals that are just totally perpetuated online, right? Mm-hmm. You know, when Britney has a breakdown and shaves her head in a Los Angeles hair salon in the Valley, the pictures go viral, right? And this would not happen to Beyonce. Mm-hmm. It just wouldn't happen. Mm-hmm. You can't imagine. The closest thing was, there was one time, and I don't know if I write about this, but there's one time there was like a camera in an elevator, and Beyonce and her sister Solange and Jay-Z were in it, and Solange, yes, like hits Jay-Z or something, right? And like there's this, mm-hmm, scandal-ish moment in which you know, what's going on? Did Jay-Z cheat on Beyonce? There's all these rumors. Well, but then even what came out of that, what does Beyonce do? And in probably you know, in cooperation with her husband and her team and everyone, she then goes on to take that moment of scandal, of loss of control of her image, and craft from it her albums, first her self-titled album, and then her album Lemonade, that's all about, you know, her marriage. And she's like, I'm telling this story, you know, I'm telling this story. The paparazzi are not telling this story. The critics and the journalists are not telling this story. Nobody's telling this story but me. And she does this all online. And so then she becomes also the first major pop star to drop a truly surprise album, with her first self-titled album, Beyonce, and then later with Lemonade, that, you know, again creates this category of the internet event in music. So she is living online in a way that feels healthy, managed, successful. She's thriving online. And, you know, meanwhile, everyone in the world is like feeling overwhelmed by social media, and like their online lives are kind of out of control. So, mm-hmm, my theory is, you know, Beyonce is the superstar of our age for many reasons. One reason is because she is embodying the ideal of online existence.
Well, Anne, we've taken up a lot of your time. I do have a final question for you. What are you working on now?
Well, I'm working on a couple different things. I am working on a book about Joni Mitchell. It's not going to be a standard biography. David Yaffe published a good biography a few years ago, or now, called Reckless Daughter. So I'm writing a book that's as my editor describes it, sort of 13 ways of looking at Joni Mitchell, or, you know, playing on the William Carlos. Is that William Carlos Williams? Oh my goodness, my poetry education. I've gone so far from my graduate school days. Anyway, I'm working on a Joni Mitchell book. And it looks at her her career in as it was shaped by the culture from which she emerged, and also as it has shaped a legacy and influenced so many artists. So I'm having fun talking to people who knew her from her earliest days, and also talking to some people that whom she's greatly influenced. So that's a project. And then I'm also working on the third season of Turning the Tables, which is the project I helm at NPR Music, which is about recentering the popular music canon on marginalized, underrepresented, or hidden in plain sight voices and legacies. So this year we're focusing on founding mothers or foremothers. So we're looking at great women artists of the early to mid 20th century. So that will be launching in a little while.
Well, these sound like fantastic projects. So I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it.
I loved talking to you. Great questions. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, take care.
Okay, bye.